This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
This morning's Lady Shir was such an important concept that I'm going to repeat this evening the essence of it and take it a step further. We were learning the piece of Tanakh in Melachim Perek Kaf Dalet that leads up to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, to the destruction of the first temple. We're at the point where Nebuchadnezzar and his army had invaded Jerusalem and conquered it. They had not yet set light to the Beis HaMikdash, but they had denuded it of all its kelim, and they had captured all of the leadership of Jerusalem. He took 10,000 of the leaders of Jerusalem, Lo Nisha, Zulas, Dalas, Amhoretz. All that were left behind were the ordinary, lowly people of the land. Ve'iskol anshei hachayil shivas alofim, and all the soldiers, 7,000 of them, ve'chorosh v'hamasgeir elef, and the artisans and the tradesmen, 1,000. Hakol giborim oisei milchomo, all of them were heroes, wagers of war. Vayevi'e melech bovel goylo bovelo, and the king of Bovel brought them to Babylon in exile. And we can picture this very tragic scene of Jerusalem, the pride of the Middle East, the pride of the Jewish people, Jerusalem in all its glory, conquered under the feet of the armies of Nebuchadnezzar, the leadership of Jerusalem having been used to many centuries of independence, many centuries of glory, during all the ups and downs. The ups and downs were primarily religious ups and downs, but politically Israel was powerful, was mighty, was respected throughout that region of the world. And here we have a scene where these same leaders of the people, king, his mother, his wives, all the officers, all the princes, all the ministers, being led away in chains, in shackles, torn, broken in spirit, broken in body, into the first exile, into the exile of Babylon. And yet, in describing their departure, their exile from Jerusalem, the Tanakh uses a strange phrase. It says, "Right now I'm in trouble. I thought you weren't coming, so I'm repeating this morning's shir." now I have to change.
I'm sure that you
weren't. The Tanakh says, "Akol giborim oisei milchoma." They were all heroes. Wages of war. Ask the Medrash, heroes? What kind of heroes are these? The chimo gvura oisim b'nei odom hama'alchim b'goylom. What heroism is there in the march into exile? What heroism is there? One sees that picture described in literature over and over again, in all sorts of forms, the retreating armies. There's nothing so humiliating as an army in retreat. Perhaps all that's more humiliating than an army in retreat is an army captured, an army of prisoners. I think so humiliating. And here they're called Giborim Oisim Milchama, Vechimo Gevura Oisim Bnei Odom Hamahalchim Bagoila. What heroism is there among people who are walking into exile? Uma Milchama Oisim Bnei Odom Azukukim Bezikim Unusunim Bishar Shalois. And what warfare do people wage when they are bound by shackles and by chains? Hello, that answers the Medrash. Kol Giborim. What does it mean? They were all heroes. The Milchamto Shel Torah, in the fight of Torah. That's what the Medrash says. We're going to analyze two issues this evening. The first, what is the place of aggressiveness in the world and in human behavior? Now I'm really getting into trouble, Mrs. Raff, but all the ladies are turning up from this morning. I was relying already on the fact that it's... You think so? Okay. The first is the question of the role, the purpose, the meaning of aggressiveness in the world. Aggressiveness is perhaps one of the most fundamental motivators in the human makeup. Aggression, the need for power, the need for influence, the need for money is part of it. That the aggressive streak in the human being is one of the most fundamental motivators of human behavior. And imagine a world where there was no aggression in people. Imagine what a beautiful world it would be. People were cooperative, helpful to one another, kind to one another. Oyavei shalom, v'roidfei shalom, there would be only peace and harmony throughout the world. What a beautiful world that would be if one could picture a world where the human being had no aggressive streak in him. If the Ribbono Shel did not implant aggressiveness into human nature, how wonderful a world it might have been. And yet the Ribbono Shel in his wisdom chose to implant aggressiveness in people. There must be a reason for it. Is it because he desires war? Is it because he desires machlokes? He desires destruction? Surely not. So what is his purpose in the placing of aggressiveness as so basic and fundamental a motivation in human behavior? And the second point we're going to analyze is the claim that is often made of how undignified it was of the Jews to go to their deaths during the Holocaust like sheep to the slaughterhouse. How much more dignified it might have been had they gone down fighting, even though they had no chance of winning. At least to go down trying, standing up for one's rights, throwing the odd stone at the German as they walked into the gas chambers, at least there would have been some dignity in that, rather than going the way they went. That's a phrase, that's a complaint, a criticism that one often hears. And it is in the light and background of that criticism that the heroes of the Holocaust are the uprisers of the Warsaw Ghetto. Although there were many others who died, under different circumstances, and in a sense we will see more heroic circumstances, but the world has taken on the Warsaw Ghetto uprising as the symbol of Jewish pride and Jewish dignity and Jewish self-esteem in those very humiliating and self-destructive years of the Holocaust. That stands out as, oh, there at least there was a group of people who refused to go to their deaths like sheep to the slaughterhouse. And many see in that uprising the origins, the beginning of the fight which was later to become the War of Independence. And that we need to analyze. The Gedolei Yisrael did not fight. The Bnei Torah and the Bnei Yeshiva did not arrange Kovna Ghetto uprisings and Vilna Ghetto uprisings. They didn't do it. They went like sheep to the slaughterhouse. Who's right? Which is a more dignified way to go? And in so doing, we analyze the concept of milchoma. What is warfare? Firstly, milchoma is uniquely human. The word war in English or milchoma in Hebrew is never used in relationship to an animal. Animals don't wage war, they fight. There's a difference between waging war and fighting. Only human beings wage war. That's peculiarly human. Number two, there is more than a coincidental similarity between the roots for the word milchoma and the root for the word lechem, which means bread, food. One on the surface could not imagine two more opposite concepts. Milchama, which destroys people, and Lechem, which gives people life, which sustains people. The essence of sustenance and the essence of destruction use words which whose root have the same letters, Lamed Ches Mem. And yet it seems, therefore, that Milchama is not necessarily destructive. Just as bread is not destructive at all, on the contrary, it is the cause, it is the root of sustenance, so it appears that milchama, warfare, might have to be viewed not as something destructive as we normally view it, but possibly as something that is a cause of sustenance. How is that possible? To view warfare as something positive. And it must be positive in some form or another, because the aggressive streak, which is the cause of warfare, is the creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So there must be a way to use that aggressive streak in a positive and constructive method. The term milchama is used in Chazal, apart from its sense of warfare, in two other senses. It's used firstly in the sense of Milchemes HaYetzer. We talk about the war with the Yetzer. What is the Yetzer? One's own inclinations, one's own drives, one's own passions, one's own desires. That's the Yetzer. And we don't talk about the challenge of the Yetzer, or the conquest of the Yetzer, or dealing with the Yetzer, or negotiating with the Yetzer. The term that is used in Chazal is Milchemes HaYetzer, waging war with the Yetzer Hara. Milchama. How can milchama be seen in a positive light? Very simply. Just as the body needs to be sustained, and it is sustained with food and given strength with food, and the neshama is sustained also, it is sustained with mitzvahs, one davens, one learns, that gives strength to the neshama, to the soul. But there's another part of the human being also, which is a very important part, which sometimes we tend to ignore. Psychologists and psychiatrists don't ignore it, but sometimes the Bnei Torah do ignore its role, its dangers, and its importance. And that is the ego. The human being has a need for a certain pride, for a sense of self-esteem. If the human being does not have a sense of self-esteem, he finds it difficult to operate. There is such a principle in the Torah as kovod. Not the negative kovod of redifas hakovod. We're not talking about people who pursue their own glorification, but there is a need to give other people kovod. Why is it necessary to give other people kovod? Because they need it. We all need recognition, we all need esteem. And the development of self-esteem is a very important factor in the growth of the human being. He has to have a healthy body, and he has to have a healthy soul, and he has to have a healthy ego. Not an oversized ego, that's gaiva. But also, as we learned last night in my brother's shiur, to which we'll refer again later on, one needs not to be a shofel ruach, not to be completely self-annihilated, that one has no self-image at all, that not either, there has to be a certain pride. Self-esteem is developed in the child and the adult through one mechanism only, and that is the winning of wars. National self-esteem is also won the same way, through the winning of wars. When a battle takes place and victory ensues, the result is an improvement in self-esteem. One feels good. I met the challenge, I conquered it, I won. And one can try anything one wants, but if a person constantly and consistently is losing the wars he wages, his self-esteem doesn't last for very long. One can take so many knocks, and there comes a time where you just can't take anymore. You go into business, and the business goes mechuvah. Get married, and the marriage lands up in divorce. Children that one has may go right off the tracks. One starts a second business, and one goes mechuvah there as well. And one tries something else, and one's framed for some crime, and one lands up in court, and on the back pages of the newspaper. And how much can one take? Comes a time that the self-esteem is gone, the ego's dead. You wage a war, you fight it out with somebody, and you win, then there's a different feeling altogether. There's the lovely story of the Rav. Every Friday afternoon, just before Shabbos, used to go to one of his balabatim, and he used to borrow $100, and right after Shabbos, used to come back to the balabos and pay him back. week after week after week, came Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the Balabos just couldn't restrain himself, and he went to the Rabbi and says, you know, before Yom Kippur, I just can't go into Yom Kippur thinking funny things about you, Rabbi, he says. I need to know, what do you do with the money? A few minutes before Shabbos, you take the money. A few minutes after Shabbos, you pay the money back. Look, if you're betting on horses, you can do it in the middle of the week as well. You don't have to do it on Shabbos. What are you doing? And the Rosh says, no, it's not that. Because when I go onto the pulpit and I give a drosha and I have to give you a musa, I feel different if I know I've got $100 in hand. Different self-esteem. Someone says, only money, what does it matter? It does matter. It matters not only in that sense, it's a funny thing, but when you're walking around with an empty wallet, even if you've got money in the bank, you feel differently. When you go to the bank and you draw a few hundred rand and you put it in your wallet, you feel different. What's the difference? That represents a certain victory. It's your money. You've worked for it. You've earned it. You've battled it out and you've got it. It's yours. That's your medal. And when people walk around with medals, their chest sticks out a good few inches more than when they're not wearing their medals. And it's not the thickness of the medal. It's the chest. Really, the chest is out more because they're wearing the medal. We like medals and our trophies and all the things that we like, which are signs of our victories. They make us walk differently. They make us feel different. I have a customer who said to me once when he was looking at a rather expensive strand of pearls, he said with a twinkle in his eye, I might consider buying these, he says, but explain to me why they're better than buying fake pearls. Would anybody tell the difference? They cost 50 rand at the OK Bazaars. Would anybody know the difference? And I was stumped. And all I could say was, if you're asking such a question, you have no business to be a jeweler. So he says, no, I'm not asking the question. I just wanted to see if you know the answer. He says, I'll tell you the answer so that you can use it on future occasions. He says, I was asked the question. I had a customer when I was struggling and I was just coming right, and a customer came in and wanted to spend a lot of money on a very beautiful strand of pearls, and I got it ready for him and I boxed it beautifully, and he came and he said to me, 1 minute, he says, before I spend this money, you explain to me why I should invest this amount of money on a strand of pearls for my wife when I could really go and get a fake set of pearls and she nor anybody else wouldn't know the difference. Because if you can explain that to me, you've got the deal. If you can't, you've lost it. And as quick as lightning, he said, buy two strands of pearls, a fake pearl set and a real set, and take two ladies to a ball. Give the one the real set and give the other the fake set, and then watch the difference in the way they walk. And he did the deal. These are our trophies. They mean something. What is it? Only material things. It doesn't matter, but it's a sign of winning a victory. It's valuable. It's a sign that something has been achieved. And when a person has been victorious, he operates differently. His self-esteem is different. When a salesman goes on one call and he gets thrown out, and he goes on a second call and he gets thrown out, and he goes on a third call and he gets thrown out, the best thing that salesman can do is to pack up, go home, have a swim, sit in the sun, learn some Gemara, and go out the next day again. Because the fourth time he goes in, he is saying already on his face, throw me out. He's already saying that. He feels so broken and so disheartened and so rejected that he doesn't have a chance of doing a deal. And then he does a deal. Big deal. All of a sudden he's walking around different, and he walks into his next place confident, satisfied, in control of himself, and he does another deal and another deal and another deal. And he says, strange, one has a streak of luck sometimes. It's not luck. It's the results of self-esteem, which are visible in the way he handles himself and the way he functions. We can't take constant rejection. We need to feel self-esteem. And our means of self-esteem, of acquiring self-esteem, is to win a battle. We see that. We see that in warfare. We see that in sports. Why this obsession with sports? Sports is warfare. Battling it out, there's a winner and there's a loser. What will happen if you play a game of soccer and you say, look, both teams, obviously the one who by the end of the time has got the most goals, that's the winner. But the other one is a winner too. Both get the same cup. Is anybody going to play the game? You say, but what's the difference? You're kicking the same ball around and it's the same fun and it's the same sport and it's the same exercise and the same camaraderie. Once there are two winners, it's no longer a battle. There's no battle, there's no fun. There's no challenge, there's no victory, there's no achievement of self-esteem. Isn't it? People aren't willing to do it. No one would be willing to go to war if the result was going to be a draw. Nobody would be willing to gamble if when you'd finished, if you won, you had to give your money back again. If it was just play money. People wouldn't gamble. The whole fun and the whole thrill of it is the chance to battle and to win. That's the thrill. And one is willing to take the risk of losing for the thrill of victory. We are so in need of victory that we're willing to risk an awful lot in order to experience victory. And nations, when they are in need of self-esteem, that's when they go to war. They don't go to war over politics, and they don't go to war over nationalism, and they don't go to war over extra territory. Those problems have sometimes been with a nation for a long time, and then all of a sudden a silly little thing happens and they're at war. When a nation is in need of self-esteem, it goes to war. And it will find good reason to go to war. When a nation is not in need of self-esteem, it doesn't go to war. It has no need to go to war. This is a disturbing concept. That means that my self-esteem can only be acquired at your expense. I've got to have somebody to fight with. And only when I've beaten him and humiliated him and vanquished him, then I've got self-esteem. So is that the world that Ribbono Shel'olam wants? Does he want us running around, cracking each other on the head, vanquishing one another so as to build our self-esteem? Here we come to this first concept, so important, the Milchemes HaYetzer. Milchoma is the lechem of the ego. Milchoma is the bread of the ego. But not all war needs another enemy. There's enough within ourselves. We're a little world inside ourselves. We can fight our wars within ourselves as well. The biggest challenge is our own self. There we've got the biggest enemy, the most sophisticated enemy, the enemy that knows our strategy before we know it. An enemy that spies us out day and night, that knows our every move, knows our strengths and our weaknesses, and is with us constantly. And this we call the Yetzer Hara. And we give the Yetzer Hara a certain personality. We talk about him like he's a person, like he's another one, like he's another person. Very often children do that, by the way. They develop split personalities. They give themselves two names, and sometimes they're A and sometimes they're B. And very often you'll find when they're being naughty, then they say they're A, and when they're being good, they're B. They actually recognize, little children, 2 years old, recognize these two sides to their personality, the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. And they realize they're at odds with each other. And they'll talk badly the one about the other. You know, child A will sometimes talk real bad about child B. What a bad child she is or he is, and how much mischief he causes. And then when you shout at the child for being naughty, he says, oh, that was child B, it wasn't child A. Child A is very good. Child A never does anything wrong. The child recognizes this two sides to the personality, the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. In winning a war, emotionally, from an ego point of view, what's important is to perceive the war and to define the objective. And if one can do that, then victory can be measured and self-esteem can be built. If one says to a child, I'm going away for a week now, I want you to be good while I'm away. That creates no challenge for the child. And when one comes back, if the child has been good, there's no self-esteem attached to the child. If the child has been naughty, there's no lack of self-esteem. One has to give the child very clear and measurable goals to achieve, which can afterwards be responded to. One says, while I'm away, I want you to finish reading this book, and I want to finish you to finish your parsha of Chumash, and I want to see a report that the babysitter is going to fill out every day that you've been well behaved. I want to see a tick again Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday when I come back. That's what I want to see when I come back. Then the child starts and he watches, and Sunday comes and he knows what he has to achieve on Sunday. He has to get a tick there, and he has to read so many pages of his book and so many prokim of his chumash, and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, and so he knows exactly what is expected of him. And when he gets to the end of the week and he looks, he doesn't even need you to come over, and he looks at the thing and he sees a tick on each day, and he sees he's finished his chumash and he's read the book, there's a feeling of victory. We defined a battle, we gave him an objective, and he achieved it. He overcame all the distractions. He overcame all the tendencies to neglect the project. And he did it little by little, and he achieved victory. There's a building of self-esteem. Can be a very little thing. One can tell the child simply to go into the kitchen and fetch a cup and saucer and bring it to the table. And the child goes, the child carries the plate and saucer carefully, 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 and brings it to the table and puts it down without having dropped it. Self-esteem is built up. Of course, there are some foolish parents, when the child goes to the kitchen to get the cup and saucer, they grab it out of his hands and they take it to the table themselves. What have you done? Deprived the child, for the possible cost of a cup and saucer, you've deprived the child of his education. You're prepared to spend thousands on his education. But nothing he'll learn in school is more important than succeeding in bringing that cup and saucer to the table. Nothing he'll learn in school will be more important. And you're not willing to risk the cost of a cup and saucer for his education. And you take it out of his hands. You've deprived him of the opportunity. You see him battling with something. You see him trying to get something down from a shelf. And he takes a chair and he schleps the chair. And then he climbs onto the chair, and he stands up, and he still can't quite reach, and he gets off the chair, and he goes to fetch a cushion, and he puts the cushion on the chair, and he gets onto the chair, and the foolish parent hasn't even allowed him to get that far. What do you want? What do you want? You want that? This one you want? This one you want? Yeah, this one you want? Okay, here it is. Deprives the child of an exciting opportunity to wage war and to win war. And then you get the other foolish parent who says, look, when you come back from school today, you're having a test, I want you to get 80%. Nothing less than 80%. The child comes back with 60%, the parent says, oh, it's also good. Don't worry, it's also fine. The child's crying, crying. The parent says, nothing to cry about, it's all alright. We discussed in the previous shiur the difference between the role of the father and the mother in that respect. But let us say the father. The father is the one who said, I want you to get 80%. The child comes back with 60%. And the father says, oh, it's also alright. You tried hard, my child, it's okay, don't worry. So, alright. What happens next time? When the father says 80%, and the child gets 80%, what does he come back with? A sense of self-esteem? What self-esteem? I got 60%, it was alright. 80% is alright. There's no challenge. There is no war. There is nothing to achieve. When the child has to work for the father's approval, and 60% doesn't get the father's approval, and 70% doesn't get the father's approval, and 78% doesn't get the father's approval, and there are tears, and there are sleepless nights, and the mother has to see the child through all that, and the father has to remain firm. Comes the day, he comes home with 80%. And his face is beaming. And he's on the way to great things. Because he's learned how to achieve. He's learned how to battle something through. He's won a war. And there's a development of self-esteem. Then he gets the medal, and the medal means something. If you dish out the medal to everybody, 50%, 40% consolation prize, doesn't mean that then the whole function of waging the war is lost. Milchemes Hayetzer is a war that we can fight daily, a war that we can fight and win without hurting anybody else. We fight and we win it within ourselves. We set the targets, we determine the strategy, we set about it, and we win or we lose. But we have to define and we have to face the facts. We mustn't try and rationalize. And so if we decide that come this coming week we're going to learn X number of hours a day, or we're going to speak not a word of Lashon Hara, or we're going to do whatever it is that we're going to do a little bit better than we've done in previous weeks, we have to sit down for a moment, we have to look the Yetzer Hara in the face and see the distractions, perceive what the inclinations not to do it are going to be, the power of inertia, the desire to do all sorts of other things, and how difficult it's going to come at times. One has to set oneself the targets, and one goes into war. And if one fails, one can't say, well, I was trying, we'll do it again next week. If you failed, you've got to see yourself being led away in shackles and in chains into the prison of war camp. You failed, you've surrendered, you've given in to your Yetzer Hara. That little miserable Yetzer Hara got the better of you. And the next time you start the war again. Until there comes a time you can look back at the week and say, I did it. Is it very important to anybody else what you did? No. Nobody else knew you were fighting a war. Doesn't matter. You knew. Every day, every moment of the day you knew. The person who tries to give up smoking, nobody has to know. But at the end of the week, a week has gone by, he hasn't touched a cigarette. And he knows what a battle it's been. He knows how he struggled. He knows how fidgety he was, how irritable he was, and how he had to control that too. He knows the craving that there was day and night. He knows what it felt like after a cup of coffee, that desire, that craving to take the cigarette, so he started avoiding the cup of coffee as well, and that was even worse. Now he can't have his coffee and he can't have his cigarette. He knows what a battle it is. Nobody else knows what's going inside him. The end of the week is won. The war has been won, and there starts a new war next week. And there's a sense of self-achievement. Has anybody been hurt in the process? No. Just the Yetzer Hara has been vanquished. And after the shiur this morning, one of the psychologists there said to me that in psychology we also have such a concept. We talk about challenges and setting objectives for oneself. And I said to her, that's not the same thing. A challenge, an objective, that's all very nice. But the real nachas of winning is to see the enemy vanquished. That's the real nachas. To see him flat on the floor with a bleeding nose and a broken arm. That's where one really gets the nachas. And for that, the Yetzer Hara has to have a personality. You're going to have challenges, objectives. How do you beat a challenge? How do you beat an objective? You achieve a challenge. That means the challenge is your friend. You achieve it. You achieve an objective. That means it's your friend. What nachas is there in winning a fight that you achieve something? What's important is to win. You want to wipe something out. You want to drive it into the ground. And for that, the Bali Musu build this picture of the Yetzer Hara, this personality that one can grapple with and fight with, portrayed with such vivid imagery in the Torah, in the battle between Esau, between Yaakov and the Soru Shel Esau, between Yaakov and his twin angel. That battle that takes place, a real battle, with a real being that he really has to overcome, fight him and wound him, or be wounded by him. That's the battle of the Yetzer, the Milchemes HaYetzer, where one can get the thrill of vanquishing the enemy in one's achievements. And nobody's been hurt. There's only progress. There's nothing wrong. There's no hurt. There's no harm. There's no destruction. That's the Milchemes HaYetzer. And within the framework of the Milchemes HaYetzer, self-esteem is built up. I set myself this challenge. I knew I'm going to meet an enemy in the challenge. The enemy was going to be the Yetzer Hara. He was going to fight with all his scheming and with all his military brilliance and with all his arsenal to make sure I don't achieve what I've just set up. Then we change from the psychologist. We don't say, I'm jolly, we're going to achieve it. We say, I'm going to wipe that Yetzer Hara off the face of this earth. By the end of the week, we'll see who's boss. Him or me. And there one sets about the task of vanquishing the Yetzer Hara, and the self-esteem is built. And all of a sudden you see a person walking with his chest out, his head high, and you don't know what's happened. Have you just won a major business deal? No. Have you just been promoted? No, he says with a little smile on his face. You don't know what's happened. He's just won a war. He's just vanquished his most bitter enemy. But that's none of your business. His pride and his self-esteem is his own affair. But he has it. He's achieved it. Unlike the other person who you see becoming more and more withdrawn, more and more depressed, more and more shy, inhibited, reserved. What's the matter? Did you lose a job? No. Were you demoted? No. Did you lose a big business deal? No. It's just that I decided tomorrow I was going to do X and I didn't do it. And then I decided the next day I would give it a try and I didn't manage. And day after day after day, my Yetzer Hara has got the better of me. How many rejections can a person take? Comes a time you get broken, the ego's gone. That's the battle that we're involved in, and it's a battle for survival. We win or we lose. And if we win, it's our whole ego which is structured and which is strengthened. And if we lose, it's our ego which is destroyed. And a person cannot function with a destroyed ego. That's the first milchoma. The Milchemes HaYetzer. There's another Milchoma referred to in Chazal, and that is Milchamto Shel Torah, the Milchoma that we've had mentioned in this very Medrash. The War of Torah. What is the War of Torah? There are many different Chazal that give you an indication of what the War of Torah is. One can go into the library of the university, and there one will find people studying One might even find the odd person discussing a problem in quiet undertones with his neighbor. That's one kind of study that one encounters. And one can say to somebody sitting there, is there never any debate? Is there never any discussion in this university? Does everybody just sit with a book in front of them? No, they'll say, debates, you've got to go, that happens in such and such an evening. These great matters are debated. There's the philosophy debate takes place on Monday nights, and there's the debate of psychologists that takes place on such and such an evening. You can go to one of those debates and you'll see the minds exchanging ideas. And you go there and there's a chairman who opens the debate, and then somebody gets up to politely propose a motion and he puts forward his argument, and then the other person gets up and says, with due respect to my learned colleague, I beg to differ on issue A and on issue B, and he puts a counter argument backwards and forwards, all very nice. And then you walk into the Beis HaMedrash of Ponovitch Yeshiva. You block your ears, the noise! How can people learn with such noise? And you look and you watch a little bit more carefully after you've gotten over the initial shock, and they're shouting at each other and screaming at each other and waving their arms and their fists at each other and virtually abusing each other. Say, my goodness, where are their manners? In Torah there's warfare. Not in secular studies. In secular studies it's with due respect I should like to differ with my learned colleague. In Torah it's not. It's in Torah. You're some kind of idiot! How can you learn Pshat and Tosfos like that? Can't you see what it says? So what's going on? Where's the courtesy? Who's right? Which is the way to study? So we learned in Gemara and Psochim, Daf Samach Vav, where the Bnei Beseiro, who were very learned people, couldn't figure out a certain halacha to do with a situation where the 14th day of Nisan falls on a Shabbos. And they ask around, is there anybody who knows, anybody who has some kind of experience in this area of halacha that can help us out? And they're told, Adam Echod Yesh She'olo Mibavel. There is a man. He comes from Babylon. The Hillel HaBavli Shema. His name is Hillel the Babylonian. So Hillel at this time was relatively unknown in Eretz Yisrael. Sheshimesh Shnei Gedole Hador Shemaya V'Avtalia. Hillel, who served under two Gedolei Yisrael, Shmaya and Avtalia. V'yodeim Pesach Doiches HaShabbos Imlov. And he knows whether Pesach pushes aside Shabbos or it doesn't under such circumstances. And you must remember who Hillel was. Hillel was the man who is quoted in the Gemara as the type that it is impossible to anger. The man who can't become abusive. The man who can't get angry. Whatever you try, he doesn't get angry. As opposed to Shammai, you remember the story. Shammai, one could make angry. Hillel, one couldn't. Hillel was the man who came to the Beis HaMedrash on a cold day and he didn't have enough money. And we made the cheshbon this morning how much he must have earned. He was a wood chopper. And he used to pay half of his daily income to the Beis HaMedrash. So figure out half of his daily income to the Beis HaMedrash. How much could the Beis HaMedrash have required from each person attending? What could the charges have been? How much a day? 2 rand a day? 5 rand a day? 10 rand a day? Say it was 10 rand a day. That means he used to pay 10 rand a day to the Beis HaMedrash, and 10 rand a day he used to live on. 300 rand a month, that's what he used to live on with his family. That was Hillel. And he comes one day to the Beis HaMedrash on a freezing cold day, doesn't have any money, not a penny. Comes to the door, and he says, my name's Hillel. And they look, I say, yeah, 10 rand please, sorry, I don't have anything. He must have said, I'll pay off. When I get, I'll pay. I don't want anything for nothing. He must have said that. Says the guard at the entrance, sorry, fellow, you know the rules here. No money, no shear. That's it. Can you imagine today what would happen if one did such a thing? Just imagine we had somebody at the door, and anybody comes without money, sorry, can't come in. So says, I'll give you a check, but we don't take checks, cash or nothing. He says, okay, I'll pay you tomorrow. Sorry, no money, no shear. Imagine what would happen in the town if that went around. The anger, the chutzpah, I want to learn Torah and they don't let me in. And not because I'm a bad Talmud, not because I can't learn, not because because I don't have the money to pay. What are they after? Are they after money or Torah? And the bad mouthing that would take place in the town after all that. What does Hillel do? The man who cannot be angered. Climbs up onto the roof, lies on the the window up on the roof, and he listens to the shiur as best he can from there. That's what he does. It's got snow in, you remember. He doesn't even feel the snow. He's so enwrapped in what's going on in the shiur. Until Shmaya and Avtaga notice that it's dark there, and they notice the form of a human being, and they have him carried down. And they thaw him out, and they find it's Hillel. That's the Hillel we're talking about. Here he comes to Eretz Yisrael, nobody knows about him. Except this one person who says, there's a man, Hillel, who studied under Shmaya and Avtaga, he knows these halachas. But Koru Loi, they asked him, they called him over, and Omru Loi, Klum Ato Yudea, do you know anything about this halacha which we cannot resolve in our Beis HaMedrash? And he answered it for them, and he proved it for them, and they asked him on it, and he answered their questions, and they became very excited, and they immediately, Miyad Hoshivuhu Barosh, Uminuhu Nosi Aleh. This unknown man who they'd never seen before, never heard of before, when they saw his brilliance of scholarship, and his pleasing personality, they immediately, the Nosi resigned. The Nosi was the head of the academy, but it wasn't just like a Rosh Hashiva. The Rosh Hashiva then was the Rosh of all the yeshivas, and he was the Rosh of the whole of the Jewish community. He was the rabbinic head, he was the scholarship head, he was the political head, the social head. The Nosi was the prince. And the existing Nosi resigned and requested Hillel to take his place. Hillel did so. It's already a bit strange. Hillel accepts the job immediately. And that whole day he taught them Hilchos HaPesach, Hitchil Mekantaron and Bedvorim, and he started to tease them. Listen to what he says. Aren't you ashamed of yourselves? An anonymous fellow from Babylon comes to Eretz Israel, and you've got to make him your Nosser, you have nobody local? Aren't you ashamed of yourself? Why do you think it is that I, who come from Babylon, can be appointed, the day I arrive, that I can already be appointed the Nosi over you? The reason is, because you're all too lazy. You knew that Shmaya and Avtalion were giving shiurim only a few hundred miles away. Why didn't you go and study under them? You were too lazy to do that. I wasn't. I studied there. That's why I'm the Nosi and you're not. Funny thing for Hillel to say. And the Gemara sort of criticizes it a little bit afterwards, but Hillel found it necessary to say that. Why? Why is it necessary to tease them? Why is it necessary to appear to be so arrogant and lord it over them? What does he want from them? He is a master teacher. He wants them to say, what do you mean we're lazy and we don't know our halachas? Just because you know one halacha that we didn't know, let us show you now what we know, what you don't know. Quit then, start learning and showing and dealing and express themselves. He wants to build their self-esteem. He wants to create a battle so that they can win the battle, because they've just suffered such a loss of self-esteem. And it doesn't help coming along and saying, don't worry, the fact that I'm the Nosi doesn't matter. Sometimes it's like this, and sometimes one day you'll also be a Nosi. Don't worry about it. That's not the way to educate. The way to educate is you've lost an opportunity because you were lazy. And that spurs them on. And that gets them going. That's kinas sofrim tarbe chochma, to use jealousy aggressively in the learning process to make people want to fight and win. And you've got to be sure they're capable of winning. There's no point in putting a battle before a Talmud if he can't win. There's no point in telling a 2-year-old child that when I come back in a week's time I want you to have written your matric, and otherwise I'm going to be very cross if you haven't done it. That's just ridiculous. It's necessary to give him the kind of battle which he can win. And Hillel battles with him, and he knows that they can win, and he knows the moment they will win, their self-esteem will be restored. That's what Hillel wants. He wants that self-esteem restored. That's Milchamto Shel Teira. That's one example of Milchamto Shel Teira. There's another beautiful example. The example in Rosh Hashanah Daf Kafhei, the famous Mishnah, where Rabbi Yeshua and Rabban Gamliel had an argument about fixing Rosh Chodesh. A very complicated halacha is exactly how Rosh Chodesh has to be fixed. And witnesses have to come, and questions whether one can accept certain types of evidence or not. And Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua used to disagree on many matters, disagreed on this matter too. But this was a very serious matter, because if they disagreed on what day Rosh Chodesh fell, then of course Yom Tov, all the Yom Tovim were going to fall on different days, and the Yom Tov that was primarily at issue was Yom Kippur. This was a Rosh Hashanah, and the question was now Yom Kippur. If I'm right, says Rabbi Yeshua, Yom Kippur is on Monday. And if you're right, Rabbi Gamliel, Yom Kippur is on Tuesday. And that means one of us are going to be doing an Isur Kores one of us are going to be eating on Yom Kippur, because I'm going to fast on Monday and you're going to fast on Tuesday, and only one of us can be right. This is now a major issue. And that means certain people are going to follow Rabbi Yeshua, and certain people are going to follow Rabbi Gamliel, and you're going to find Klal Yisrael fasting on two different days, and that could be the beginning of an insoluble split in the community. And here we see Rabbi Gamliel, who was the Nossi, that same position that we described a little while ago, and he was a Nossi of enormous stature, both intellectual and in leadership. And Rabbi Gamliel simply says to Rabbi Yeshua, "Goizroni alecho, I decree." Whatever the day is, you come and visit me with your stick and with your purse on that Yom Kippur, and you come and have lunch with me. And now what's going to happen? You can imagine how the whole land was in a state of tension. Was Rabbi Yeshua going to go, or wasn't he going to go? The end of the story is he went and Rabbi Gamliel kissed him when he walked in. But you see the power, the uncompromising fast, the uncompromising steadfastness of Rabbi Gamliel. The unwillingness to flinch one little bit from that which he holds to be right. And Rabbi Yeshua is junior to him, and he just has to take it and he has to come. That's Rabbi Gamliel. Milchamto shel Torah, a battle in Torah, battle down to the end. The waiting that Yom Kippur must have made the Cuban Missile Crisis look like child's play. Waiting and wondering, are the Russians going to go back or are they going to carry on? Those of you who remember that period. Very, very nerve-wracking. What are they going to do? Playing poker. Who's going to give in? And the stakes? The destruction of the world. That's what we're looking at. World War. This was no less. Is Rabbi Yeshua going to give in? Is he going to be there? And Machlokes will be saved? Or is the community going to split down the middle in a way that it might never be able to be repaired? And people waited and waited and waited. And one can imagine the crowds gathering outside the homes of Rabbi Yeshua and of Rabbi Gamliel. And you can imagine the sigh of relief as Rabbi Gamliel appeared on his Yom Kippur with his stick and his purse in his hand and made his way to the home of Rabbi Gamliel. That same Rabbi Gamliel got into trouble once again with Rabbi Yeshua when there was a Talmid, Echot, a certain Talmid, who did what a Talmud should never do. This is a Gemara in Brochus Daf Kaf Zayin, where he asked Rabbi Yeshua Shaila, is Ma'ariv obligatory or is it a voluntary tefillah? And Rabbi Yeshua answers him that it's voluntary. He then goes to Rabbi Gamliel and says, Rabbi Gamliel, I have a Shaila for you. Is Ma'ariv voluntary or is it obligatory? Rabbi Gamliel says obligatory. He's made enough mischief already, he should just go away quietly, but he doesn't. He says, interesting you should say so, Rabbi Gamliel. I happened to be talking to Rabbi Yeshua the other day, and he said Rishus. He said it's allowed. Don't forget, Rabbi Gamliel is the Nossi. Rabbi Yeshua is junior to Rabbi Gamliel. Ha, says Rabbi Gamliel. Wait until Baalei Tresim come to the Beis HaMedrash. Interesting, what does Rashi say the word Baalei Tresim means? It means the Talmidim. Wait until the Chachomim come, says Rashi. The holders of the shield is what it means, really. The holders of the shields. Chachomim amenatzchim zeh ba'halocha. Wait until the chachomim come who are victorious over one another in halocha. Chamto shel Torah, again we see the shield holders. Wait until the battalions come. Wait until the army is gathered and we'll deal with Rabbi Yeshua. And the Talmidim start streaming into the Beis HaMedrash. Rabbi Gamliel gets up at the shtender and he turns to the Talmid. He points him out, the one that made the mischief. And he says, young man, you had a shaila for me. What is your shaila? And the young man says, is Ma'ariv obligatory or is it just a voluntary tefillah? And Rabbi Gamliel says it is obligatory. Is there anybody present who wishes to take issue on that point? And Rabbi Yeshua says, nobody here wishes to take issue. Says Rabbi Gamliel to Rabbi Yeshua, V'haloi mishimcha omru li rishus, I heard in your name that you said it is permissible, it is not obligatory, that you disagreed with my psak. Omali said, Yeshua amida raglecho v'yuhidubach. Yeshua, stand up and let the one who heard you say that declare whether it is true or not. And Rabbi Yeshua backs down on that issue and says, no, I can't contest. I did in fact say it. That's what I believe. And he then, Rabbi Yeshua, then stood standing and the battle continued between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Gamliel. And the Talmidim, the rest of the community, the rest of the Talmidei Chachomim began to get a little irritated and concerned. Ad sheronenu kol ha'om v'omru l'chutz pisam aturgaman And they eventually said to Chutzpitz HaTurgeman, the Turgeman was the man who used to say over the shir. Rabbi Gamliel used to say the shir, and the Turgeman used to explain it. And they said to the Turgeman, Omer, stop saying the shir. Don't, let's just stop it. But Omer, then he stopped. Amri, they said, Ad kamo netzah revenez. How long are we going to allow Rabbi Gamliel to continue persecuting Rabbi Yeshua? They began to take exception. But Rosh Hashanah ishtaket tzare. Last year, Rosh Hashanah, do you remember what happened? That he made him come to his home on his day, Yom Kippur, with his stick and with his purse. He humiliated Rabbi Yeshua. Bivchoyos b'maisad Rabbi Tzodok tzare. With the bivchoyos with Rabbi Tzodok, he humiliated him. Hochonami tzare. Today he has once again humiliated Rabbi Yeshua. We cannot have that. Tov and Avri. Let us dismiss Rabbi Gamliel. And they took a vote and they decided that the body of opinion was not with Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel needs to be dismissed. And the whole question of who should they appoint? The first consideration, of course, was Rabbi Yeshua. And they said, no, that would be too hard on Rabban Gamliel. He would suffer every time he saw Rabbi Yeshua sitting in his seat. It would cause him suffering. It's not necessary to cause him so much suffering. They tried Rabbi Akiva. They felt he wasn't 100% correct, although his learning was, of course, fit for it. And eventually they took Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who at the time was rather nervous about the job. And he said, Omaluhu Ezel v'imlich bein shebesi. Let me ask my wife. If I come home and tell her that I'm the Nossi, that's all my life is worth. I'd better go and consult with her first, and that's all. It's all very well for me to become the Nossi, but she has to become the wife of the Nossi. And I can't impose that upon her without her permission. So he goes home. Ozel v'amlich bidvisu, and he asks his wife, Omrele, she says to him, what do you want it for, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? What do you need it for? You see what happens. Are you greater than Rabban Gamliel? And they're throwing him out. How long do you think it will take before they throw you out? Do you need such humiliation in your life? Omer lo, he says to her, Lishtamish inish yemer chada bekasa demukre, v'lemochel ispe. Even to drink only one day out of a good crystal glass, it doesn't matter if it breaks the next day. To have one day to drink out of. To be the Nossi of Israel, the Rosh Yeshiva, for one day, isn't that worth it? So she tries another tack. She says, Hisle Chivato. You don't have any grey hairs, you're too young. He was 18 years old at the time. You can't hold a position like that. You need a certain dignity, you need a certain credibility, and you're just too young for the job. Ho, Yomer ba Tam Nisre Shomer Havi Israchishle Nisa ba Hadule Tam Nisare Dare Chivato. That day he was 18 years old and a miracle took place and 18 rows of white hairs appeared and his wife realized there's nothing more to argue with, that he had to be appointed the Nossi, and he was. Immediately he goes into the Beis HaMedrash, 18 years old, taking over from Rabban Gamliel, the type of character we've just seen, who this Rabban Gamliel was. And Rabban Gamliel used to be very fussy as to who he allowed into the yeshiva. Only people, Shetochon Kaboron, only people who had absolute integrity, no fake about them at all, nothing superficial about them, their insides had to be like their outsides, they had to be Bali Midas, they had to be fine people, every one of them. Which means the yeshiva was fairly small. Comes Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he's now the Nossi, he has a different policy, he wants the doors to be open. And they came and they opened the doors, and they had to add, some say, 400 rows of benches, some say 700 extra rows of benches into the Beis HaMedrash to cater for the influx of new people that came as a result of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's policy. So imagine Rabbi Gamliel standing there, watching his policy overturned, seeing 700 new people, not 700, 700 new rows of people. That's probably a few thousand extra people coming into the Beis HaMedrash the day after he's dismissed. For the day he is dismissed. He nearly had a heart attack, the Gemara says. He didn't realize that he was stopping so many people who wanted to learn Torah. And he's comforted in a semi-miraculous way. And so it goes on. And now just picture the situation. He has this 18-year-old, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, sitting in the seat of Rabban Gamliel, commanding the respect of thousands of Talmidim. Rabban Gamliel sat in that seat yesterday. There were only a few hundred people in the Beis HaMedrash. Today, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah sits in the seat, and there are thousands of people in the Beis HaMedrash. And the Gemara says there wasn't a halacha that was in doubt that wasn't solved that day. It was buzzing. It was dynamic. What was going, it was just incredible. The learning and the brilliance, the creativity of all this that took place on that day in the Beis HaMedrash. And right through Chazal we have scattered statements of things that occurred that day. Very often you'll see the Gemara says, on that day, and it's referring to that particular day, this was discussed and this was resolved and this is how it was resolved. It was a historic moment. What does the ex-Nasi do? Does he go to the presidential retirement home in California, quietly wait for his days to come? What does he do? What does he do? You talk about self-esteem. Imagine what a knock Rabban Gamliel's self-esteem must have taken. Seeing everything overturned, and so successfully overturned, says the Gemara, the Af Rabban Gamliel, even Rabban Gamliel, Loimono atzmoi bibeis hamedrash afilu shoachas. Not even for a brief moment did Rabban Gamliel excuse himself from the Beis HaMikdash. Not even to compose himself. Not even just to go outside and take a walk and pull himself together again. It wasn't necessary. He simply went to the back of the Beis HaMikdash, took his seat among the Talmidim, and carried on as if nothing had happened. That's that same Rabban Gamliel who decreed upon Rabbi Yeshua, you come to me on the day of your Yom Kippur with your stick and your bag in your hand. That's Milchamto Shel Torah. What does this Milchamto Shel Torah mean? It means that we do battle with one another. Unlike the Milchemes HaYetzer, we do battle with one another. Milchemes HaYetzer is within myself. I don't battle with anybody else, and I don't vanquish anybody else, I vanquish myself. And my self-esteem comes from my own victory upon myself. But here we're talking about Milchamto Shel Torah, the battle of Torah. You're in the Beis HaMedrash and they're fighting over an issue. One wins, one loses. Self-esteem of the winner, what happens to the loser? Where's his self-esteem? This Gemara we've just learned shows us what happens to the loser. Rebitel atzmoi v'beis hamedrash afilu shorachas. No loss of self-esteem at all. How do we achieve that? That we can go into battle with a colleague, a battle to death, and lose, and have no loss of self-esteem. How does that happen? The answer is very simple. Who was Rabbi Yeshua fighting for? He was fighting for Emes, he was fighting for the truth. Who was Rabban Gamliel fighting for? He was fighting for Emes, he was fighting for the truth. Who won? Emes won. So Rabban Gamliel won. And so did Rabbi Yeshua. But you will ask, we just said such wars don't mean anything. If both sides win, then neither side play. What kind of battle is that? Milchamto Shel Torah, does it mean that everybody wins and everybody gets a consolation prize? No. The loser has a second battle. The winner, his medal is that he's won. The battle is over. Rabbi Yeshua won. Rabban Gamliel was forced to resign. The battle's won for Rabbi Yeshua. He can sit and relax. What about Rabban Gamliel? He is launched immediately into a second battle. Milchemes HaYetzer. How am I going to cope with this severe disappointment? That doesn't affect any other enemy. The enemy is my own Yetzer Hara. And he works on himself, and he works on himself, and he's relaxed. What was I fighting for? He says to himself. I was fighting for Emes. And who won? Emes won. I was fighting for Kovod HaTorah, and who won? Kovod HaTorah won. So what am I feeling miserable about? Let me stay in the Beis HaMedrash. Let me sit at the feet of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and let me continue my work. What I was fighting for has won. What I stood for has been victorious. So what do I have to feel bad about? My self-esteem? The fact that I was Nossi yesterday and I'm an ordinary person today? That is a challenge which only I have got. And I've won that too. Rabbi Yeshua didn't have the schus to have that battle. And who knows whether he could have won that battle. I know I can. I have won it already. I've come out above. We both had two battles. The one was Milchamto Shel Torah. Milchamto Shel Torah we both won. So it's one each. But I was given, for losing that battle, in inverted commas, I was given a second battle, to fight with my own self-dignity. And I won that too. And therefore I'm in fact the victor. I have just fought a battle which no other human being has ever had to fight. And I've come out on top. The fact that I can sit at Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's feet means that I have a quality which Rabbi Yeshua doesn't know whether he's got. And whether Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah doesn't know whether he's got. There's only one person in this Beis HaMedrash that knows that he can be victorious
over the ultimate humiliation and emerge with his self-esteem intact. And that man is me, Rabban Gamliel. And with that self-esteem and with that knowledge that he has such perfect mastery over himself, he can sit in the Beis HaMedrash relaxed and continue his work without batting an eyelid. Not for a moment did he have to take a walk outside in order to compose himself. So secure was he within himself that he was able to handle himself. So often we hear of people who've become bitter and twisted and distorted because they've had a severe disappointment in life. They struggled all their life for a particular office or for a particular ambition, and right at the end it's collapsed, they've failed, and they've become bitter and embittered. That doesn't happen to Rabban Gamliel. Such a disappointment in his life, and doesn't affect him at all. He's able to control himself. That's milchamto shel Torah. That's the battle of Torah. And of course it needs to be understood that milchamto shel Torah can only be fought when milchemes hayetzer has been won. If one enters the milchamto shel Torah without having become victorious already in the milchemes hayetzer, if one goes into battle in the Beis HaMedrash before one has beaten oneself at home, then what does that mean? That we call is lilmud al-manas lekanter. That's called learning to be aggressive. The purpose of your learning is to humiliate others, to be victorious over others. And that's neach lo yishelo nivro, say Chazal. A person would have been better off never having been created than to go into the Beis HaMedrash for the sake of humiliating others, lording it over others, showing off in front of others, rather never have been created, because that is so destructive. So milchamto shel Torah has a tnai, it has a condition. One may only be aggressive in one's learning if one has been victorious over oneself. One may enter the battlefield of the Beis HaMedrash only when one has beaten oneself in the battlefield of one's own ego. Then one can fight milchamto shel Torah. If you go into a Beis HaMedrash and there are people who are arrogant, there are people who want honor, there are people who are aggressive, and they're fighting with each other over the Gemara, that's nothing to praise. That's arrogance, that's lakanter, they're trying to destroy one another. But if they find people, a Hillel who cannot be angered, becomes angry in the Beis HaMedrash, that's milchamto shel Torah. A Rabban Gamliel who can sit on the benches with everybody else after he's been the Nasi, and is lo mevatel atzmo in the Beis HaMedrash, afilu shoachas, not for a moment does he need to leave the Beis HaMedrash. Such mastery does he have upon himself. Such a man is entitled to fight milchamto shel Torah. He can decree upon Rabbi Yeshua to jolly well come and visit me on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur that falls on your day. Because that's really milchamto shel Torah. That's not arrogance, that's not lording it over anybody else, that's not aggressiveness. That's milchamto shel Torah. He's been victorious over himself and he's entitled to do that. There has to be that prerequisite of self-victory before one goes into battle in the Beis HaMedrash. Imagine then the heroes, the Giborim of the Holocaust. Imagine our heroes here being led away by Nebuchadnezzar in their chains and in their shackles, and off they're walking. And we see that as they walk, dragging their legs along with the iron balls, trying to carry the chains that in which they find themselves bound, one listens and one finds they're arguing with one another. They're fighting with one another. And one thinks, goodness, being led away in exile, is this a time to fight? And we go a little nearer, and what are they fighting about? They're fighting about Pshat and Aramba. They're fighting about the understanding of a difficult sugya in the Gemara. How can you learn it this way? And don't you remember how the Rebbe taught us in the Beis HaMedrash? And didn't you chazal the shir? And why haven't you learned it this way? And of course it must be this way. Don't you know this Gemara? And don't you know that Gemara? And how will you explain this if you learn it like that? And the other one saying, no, you're missing the point. You don't understand the principle. If you look at the principle here, and they're arguing and debating and discussing, and they're becoming aggressive with one another. Thank goodness. Are these people who've lost their self-esteem? No. They're involved in milchamto shel Torah. They're busy fighting. They're in the midst of the war. They're in the midst of the battle. And there's a certain glory to battle. When soldiers are fighting, there's a glory there before there's a loss. Absolute glory. And these people's eyes are burning bright. Their faces are alight with enthusiasm and with dynamicism. They don't fit the role. They don't seem to be prisoners. That's the dignity with which they were led away.
Gibeirim, v'isei milchama, says the Medrash. They were gibeirim b'milchamto shel Torah. Heroes in the fight of Torah. They continued their learning. They continued their discussions in halacha as they were being led away. And I gave the example this morning of the Ruchonon Wasserman, who during the last days of his life was hiding in a house in the ghetto of Kovna, I think it was, where there were some other people. His daughter was there and various other Talmidim were there. And he learnt every day. He had a shtender at the bottom of the staircase, and that's where he learnt. The Nazis were going from house to house and emptying the houses of the Jews and killing them off, Kaseder, one after another. So how long was it going to take for them to get to the house in which he was residing? And yet he stood every day exactly as he did in the yeshiva with his gemara open and carried on his learning exactly as it was. Busy b'milchanto shel teiro. And when the Germans broke into the home and called him, he said to his daughter, go upstairs and bring me my Shabbos jacket and my golden watch. I'm going to be mekayim the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem now. And off he goes with his head up and his shoulders back to be mekayim the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, to teach the people who are about to die how they have to die, what Kiddush Hashem is, what it means, and what they're doing. Off he goes. And the secularists say he should have spent that time involved in a brawl with some fat Nazi. That would have been dignified. If he'd been rolling on the ground, punching a Nazi in the face and getting punched himself, being hit over the head with the butt of a rifle, that would have been dignified. That's how we wanted to see our Gedolei Yisrael going to their death. Instead of that picture of absolute dignity, involved in Milchamto Shel Torah until the last minute. That was Rabbi Chonon Wasserman and countless others. And even the ordinary people who were not learned or had already not for so many years in the concentration camps had been detached from their learning, who couldn't, they too went to the chambers singing Ani Ma'amin. Going, believing that Yiddishkeit is being utterly destroyed, that every Jew is being wiped off the face of the earth, they go to the gas chamber singing Ani Ma'amin. Their bodies might have been broken, but they were certainly upright in spirit. Their heads were certainly thrown back in terms of their internal ego as far as it was possible to be. And what should they rather have been doing? Trying to fight a few Germans on the way or going with dignity? That is Jewish dignity, to go with Milchamto Shel Torah, to be involved in Milchoma, to be involved in the battle of the minds, to be involved in the learning of Torah right until the last minute. That is the greatest dignity that there can possibly be in being taken a prisoner and giving one's life. There is no better way to go if one has to go. It needs to be understood finally that the purpose of all this is not that God made aggression inside us as a midah, that we are aggressive people, and this is an outlet for our aggression. That's what the secular psychologists say. People have aggression and we have to find legitimate outlets for that aggression. That's not true. People don't have aggression. People develop the midah of aggression by being aggressive. When you do aggressive things, you become an aggressive person, but that's not how the Ribono Shel Olam created us. He gave us the koach milchoma. He gave us the power, the potential to fight battles. He gave us the potential to be aggressive because we need that in Milchemes Hayetzer. We need that in Milchamto Shel Torah, but it was not his will that we should become aggressive people. My brother Reb Refoy last night gave that brilliant shiur in explaining the difficulty in the Rambam in Shmoneh Prochim, where he explained the difference between a midah and a mitzvah. Sometimes there is a certain thing which becomes a human quality. That's you, that's part of what you are. And one deviation from that means you're not that. Because if that's what you are, you never deviate from it. And there's another thing which is a mitzvah. Sometimes one has to do things which are not one's character. It doesn't matter, it's an action which has to be done, it's not you. And so we're not saying that the Ribono Shel Olam made us or wants us to become aggressive people. That's Lilmud Amanas Lekanter. If you're an aggressive person, Meach Lo Yishalo Nivro, it would be better you were never born than to learn with aggression. What we're saying is, no, you're not an aggressive person. But there are times when you have to act with a degree of aggressiveness. Hillel had to tease the Talmidim. Rabban Gamliel had to assert himself with Rabbi Yehoshua, not because he was naturally an assertive person. We saw later on he wasn't. Hillel, we know, was not an aggressive person, but the ability for a non-aggressive person to be aggressive when he needs to, that's what's important in Milchamto Shel Torah.
And with that, the Tolzer Rov explains why it says, very strange Gemara, Kol Talmid Chacham Sheina Nekim V'Neiter K'Nachash Eina Talmid Chacham. Any Talmid Chacham who is not aggressive and vengeful like a snake is not a Talmid Chacham. And many try to deal with it. The Rambam brings it and gives an explanation, and they say, the Rambam says, depends. If you're being offended in your personal capacity, you've got to just accept it. Doesn't be aggressive. But if in your capacity as a Talmid Chacham, that means the Torah is being offended, the Torah is being humiliated, there you've got to become like a snake. You've got to become aggressive and vengeful like a snake. The Tolzer Rov says, for that it would have been sufficient then to say, the Talmid Chacham chayev linkum v'linto. There are times when even a Talmid Chacham has to be vengeful and has to be aggressive. But it doesn't say that. It says he's not a Talmid Chacham if he can't do that. Explains the Tolzer Rov, a Talmid Chacham who cannot be vengeful, that means he's a timid person. And therefore the goodness he does is not because he's decided to be good, it's because that's his nature. A Talmid Chacham has to be able to be vengeful when the occasion calls for it. And then you know that the goodness is taka good. Then you know that the kindness is taka kind. And when he's vengeful, it's vengeful. We have that with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ki El Kono, Ki Kel Kono. The Ribbono Shel Olam is a jealous God, a vengeful God. And we talk about Kel Rachum V'Chanun, a merciful God, a graceful God. What is he? Split personality? There's no stereo. The nature is a nature of rachami. But there's an ability, even with a person who naturally is merciful, to be vengeful and to be aggressive when he needs to be. That's part of the midah that he requires. And so it is that we find that yes, there is a dignity in a battle, but there's only a dignity in a battle that you win. When people say that the Warsaw Ghetto uprisers went with dignity, we take issue on that. We take issue. It's not for us to judge and decide whether they should have done what they did or shouldn't have done. We don't know much of the circumstances. We don't know what really motivated it, what they planned to achieve. It's very difficult to comment on the rights and wrongs of it. That's different altogether. It might have been the right thing to do, but it certainly wasn't dignified. There is no dignity in losing a war. None at all. There is no dignity in losing a battle. The dignity is in victory. Rabbi Chonon went to his death and he won. He beat them. They failed in breaking his spirit. He went in Milchamto Shel Torah and he won the Milchamto Shel Torah. The Jews who went to the gas chamber singing Ani Maamin waged war and they won the war. The Milchamto Shel Torah, at least the Milchemes HaYetzer, they were involved in. The Yetzers must have said to them, let's throw a stone at the Nazi, let's go to our death that way. That must have been the Yetzer Hara. Well, let's just do nothing. Let's just not care anymore. Let's commit suicide. That must have been what the Yetzer Hara said. And they overcame that. In their weakness, they overcame that with their moral strength. And they sang Ani Maamin as they went to their deaths. They won the Milchama. They won the war. They weren't fighting the Nazis. A war can be won only after you've defined who you're fighting against. That's what you need to know. Is South Africa fighting the Angolans or is it fighting the Cubans? If it's fighting the Cubans, then you haven't won the war until the Cubans are gone. If you're fighting the Angolans, then who cares whether the Cubans are there or not? You need to beat the Angolans, not the Cubans. You need to know who you're fighting. If you're fighting the Nazis, you don't stand a chance. You might as well surrender. If you're fighting your own Yetzer Hara, oh, you stand a very good chance and keep the fight up. Their enemy was the Yetzer Hara and they won. Rebbe Chonon's enemy was, he was fighting Sheker and he won. MS won. Kiddush Hashem won. He was fighting against Chilul Hashem and Kiddush Hashem won. Rebbe Chonon won the battle. The ghetto, the Warsaw ghetto uprisers were fighting the Nazis and they lost. No heroes in that. There's sadness in that. There's tragedy in that. What has to be remembered with pride are the korbonos that went with dignity. That's a different thing altogether. And so we have to know in our own little lives too that once we've defined our enemies, we can build our self-esteem. If we go out there in the street fighting Anglo-American, then we don't stand much chance. And the best is if you can't beat them, you just join them. Joining them doesn't do much for your self-esteem, but At least you don't suffer the knocks either. But who says you have to go out fighting Anglo-American? One goes out each day fighting the little things that need to be fought. Oneself, one's own nonsense, one's own irritabilities, one's own little things that get in the way of one's own progress. One sets small goals for oneself. One identifies the distractions and one sets out determined to beat those distractions, to beat the Yetzer Hara that breathes those distractions. And each day one can come home feeling satisfied that there's been a nitzocha and there's been a victory in the milchamtosh, in the milchemes hayetzer, in the fight against ourselves. And as we proceed and we're able to achieve more and more victory in that battle, we enter the new and the bigger battlefield of milchamtosh yetzero, where we enter the fight for emes, the fight for truth, and step by step there too we become victorious. And little by little our self-image is built, our self-esteem is built, our dignity is built, and with that newfound dignity, our avodas Hashem becomes even more potent.